Welcome to the Business of Show Business with me, Jamie Boddy. I'm joined by industry experts and up-and-coming creatives as we unpack the skills, stories, and side hustles behind the entertainment and creative industries. So if you are ready to thrive and not just survive in showbiz and the arts and culture sector, you're in the right place. Hello and welcome back to the Business of Show Business. Today I'm joined by theatre journalist, critic and reviews editor at The Stage, Sam Marlowe. We'll be talking about why criticism is so important in the arts and culture sector, what entertainment journalism is and all things the business of show business. Sam, how is it going?
It's going really well, thank you. Yeah, it's a busy time at the moment in the run-up for Edinburgh.
Yes.
And we have our debut awards coming up at The Stage as well. So we've been very busy with that. So yeah, it's intense. It doesn't stop.
And I feel like, so at the time of recording, just in case anyone tunes into this later in the year, we've had some big shows that we've had Evita just open, yeah. You've had Disney's Hercules.
Yep.
So it's been, not only is it Edinburgh Fringe crazy, it's like West End seems to have quite a nice influx of newer shows.
That's true. Yeah, it has really felt like a bit of a roller coaster lately. And yeah, it's been big stuff, like you say, and big kind of very mainstream, quite glitzy stuff. So yeah, it's interesting.
So before we dive into what exactly is theatre, critique and journalism, you actually started off your journey as an actress.
I did.
Which I think is quite... Because obviously we met actually when I used to work at The Stage, and a lot of people there have either maybe been a performer or they've studied performing arts or they just love it. But like a lot of people in on the other side of the industry are from that background. So what was your life like as an actress, and when did the point come when you were like, oh, actually, I've got this other skill set that I want to utilise?
Yeah. What was my life like as an actress?
Yeah, a mess. I'm joking. It's great.
Impoverished. Yeah. That hasn't really changed. You know what it is. It is like... it's rejection on a daily basis, isn't it? Yeah. Really, which is obviously really hard. And I do think the resilience that is required for that is something else. It's next level. However, you know, we know that when we go into it.
Yeah.
So I came out of drama school. I went to Mountview, so I did acting and musical theatre. I did, in fact, do a postgrad course because I'd done a degree in drama first, which was mainly just because I couldn't get funding to go to drama school. Yeah. It was not because I was feeling profoundly intellectual. But in retrospect, I think it was not the worst thing, because that is where I started to develop a bit of a taste for what they called on that course critical practice, which involved analysis and taking theatre work apart and working at how it's built and how it's put together, and evaluating it, which has come in very... handy subsequently. But I was very much at that time grease paint in the veins, you know. Yeah. That's what I wanted to do. So I went to Mountview, and I went straight from Mountview into sort of touring panto, which was my first ever acting job. It was very exciting. It was very unglamorous. It was the back of a van and put your own setup. And we had one light, I think, which we were responsible for rigging. And the guy playing the villain broke the light at one of the shows.
Very in character.
Oh, it was and we were all then traumatized about, I'm not rigging the light. I'm not breaking the light. So that was kind of the level we're talking. But, you know, it's fun. My first job. And then that came to an end. And I thought, whoa, you know, this is a strange feeling, suddenly not having anything particularly to get up for, and then having to rethink your professional life and how you're going to get by and still call yourself an actor.
Yeah.
Whatever else you might have to do to put food on the table. So I did start sort of tinkering with reviewing at that early stage, and I did it in between acting jobs for some years. And at one point I had a pseudonym pen name, but I don't know why I didn't stick with it, but I don't know, perhaps it was vanity. quite possible.
I get, because obviously if you're auditioning for these shows and
you're
sort of reviewing them, you've got to kind of keep those worlds separate.
Yes, I mean, I think I did sort of feel that initially, but gradually the writing sort of started to take over, and I found, well, there is... actually, I think, quite a big performative aspect to writing as well. So I started to feel that that some of my performing instincts were being satisfied in a different way. And gradually, there was just more of that and less of the acting. And in fact, I was in a show in Edinburgh when I decided, I think I've had enough of this.
Yeah.
It's like, this is not... it is so hard. It's so hard. And that's okay if you feel that it's loving you back to some extent. But if you get to a point where you just think, I'm not getting enough out of this to compensate for the times when it's kicking me in the tits. Yeah. You know, that's the point at which you have to say, well, you only go around once, and do I want to spend my life being kicked in the tits? Yeah. So that was kind of the conversation that I had with myself. And yeah, from that point, the writing kind of took over, which is not to say that it's that much easier to make a living doing that.
No, but like, I think, yeah, having worked in arts journalism and arts marketing, the arts in general, as we know, is underpaid. People should be paid so much more for their skill set, the hours they give. But mm-hmm. I think what I love about what you said there is that you were getting some of that same performative buzz, or it was kind of scratching that itch, which I think that's the hardest thing to replace when you've been a performer and you're trying to find the next thing, or the thing to run adjacently to your performance career to keep you going. That's is finding it. That buzz. So it's so lovely that you found that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's really, really tricky. And I think actually probably young people coming into the industry now are better at that than people were when I was doing it, because the kind of idea of a portfolio career is much more mainstream now. Yeah. Whereas back then it was sort of like, well, what are you doing with your life? And it was very sort of goal oriented. And so you really beat yourself up if the one thing you decided that you were doing wasn't working for you that week or that month or that year, which is not good for your head, really. No.
And I think that's the thing a lot of graduates now I work with when I'm lecturing or coaching is that entrepreneurial mindset, that seed's already been planted, whether that's from school, due to social media and influence, and there's that multi-hyphenated career blueprint is maybe a lot more prevalent now than it was even when I graduated as well. Because you kind of, I'm sure when you transitioned to journalism, people will be like, oh, so you're not going to the acting audition, or you're not doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, did you fail at that then? Yeah.
Like, I'm not less than, like, I'm still of value.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I do think, as I say, like, my nephew and his girlfriend are both actors as well, and both have second careers, that are things that they love to do. So it's not just, in my day, it was more like, oh, you might be waiting tables or working behind a bar, and sort of dropping shifts at a moment's notice to race off and audition. And of course, you have self-taping, which is the norm now, which wasn't, again, the case back then. So I guess the industry has changed a lot since I was doing it.
Yeah. And do you find now that you've obviously been on this side of the pen and paper, there's probably quite a lot of transferable skills from when you were an actor, whether that is the resilience, because when you're obviously, although you're the reviews editor now, you've been a freelance writer for many years. So again, it's rejection. Are your pitches getting accepted? It's the networking and hobnobbing. So that performative smile. Did you find there were quite a lot of transferable skills, even if some of the soft skills that kind of moved over when you shifted to journalism?
Yeah, I think that is true. But the big difference is that when you're an actor, you can't do it alone. You really can't. So I mean, I suppose you can mount a one-person show, but even then you need someone to light you, you know, all of that stuff. Whereas you can sit and write, and although you might struggle to find somebody to print that for you, you have the option of doing it yourself. And it is a completely different working environment in that respect. So I think one of the things that probably some people would struggle with is that what they might call isolation, but I actually find quite blissful. Yeah. I'm quite good. I'm quite successful at being on my own, and I quite like working alone. So I think that's worked out quite well for me. But it is a very sort of particular quality of the job, I think. But you're right. Yes. I mean, all that kind of sensitivity and empathy and those kind of skills. And also, you know, all the stuff that you learn at drama school about Stanislavski and emotional memory and all that sort of stuff, that all comes into writing in a similar way. There's something, I don't know, quite methody about writing when you're trying to absorb emotion and then express it in a way that's digestible for somebody that wasn't in the room when the thing that you saw happened.
Well, also, you're coming from a place of having an expert voice, which is good. So although you're the reviews editor at the stage, some of your other bylines, you've written for The Times, The Independent, The iPaper, Time Out, Metro. You've been on BBC Radio 4's Front Row, Sky News. So you have an expert voice. And I think being a performer, you can almost dissect that show, or you can bring into consideration that director's previous piece because you know what it is. So I think your value is, your worth is almost even heightened now, I would hope to think, as a journalist and reviewer, because you have all that experience as well.
Yes, it is. I'm very valuable.
Yes. So as a reviewer.
But I think as well, you do know, as a former performer, what goes into the sausage, which is really helpful. I mean, it will occur to you, how does that person get from there? You know, how does that entrance work? What's the technical stuff that's going on behind the scenes, in a way that I think perhaps doesn't occur to writers that haven't ever been in that process? So there's that. But yes, context is important for sure. Yeah.
So if we look at your current role as the reviews editor at the Stage, how many emails do you get daily? Because I think so many PRs will want to know, first of all, of how to get into your mailbox, but also, as a reviewer yourself, still as a reviews editor, you're getting new shows that want reviewers at, as well as long established shows, cast changes, concerts, one-off. It's no longer just what's in the West End will get reviewed. There's such a broad spectrum. So first of all, how many emails do you typically get daily or weekly? Or can you even think off the top of your head, you just get so many?
Yeah, I get hundreds a day. It's in the hundreds. It's peaks and troughs a little bit, but at busy times it can be sort of 300, 300 plus.
Gosh.
So yeah, a lot.
Because obviously you've got Edinburgh Fringe, you've got Christmas season.
Yes.
Those are probably
panto
two.
Panto season is insane.
Yeah, because I don't know how many pantos must be in the country now, but a lot of them, because they're all long-running shows, aren't they, typically? So they would probably have a reviewer, whether it's from national or local press. Mm. How do you manage kind of your workflow then as a reviews editor? Because you're also line managing other editors. You've got other reviewers. You have to kind of look through that lens and edit their copy as well, send it to the sub-editors. There's so much. How do you kind of manage your workflow with that? Because also, you're working unsociable hours, because you are reviewing a show sometimes to 11 p.m.
Yeah.
And then you have to file that copy by 10 a.m. the next morning.
Yeah, yeah. It's a funny job in that way. Yeah. It's a bit vampiric.
Yeah.
I mean, that is something that I've just got used to over the years, I think, really, is that you're always a little bit sleep deprived, because there's just no way around it.
Yeah.
You have an early start in the morning and you have a late finish at night a lot of the time. So that is kind of the nature of the beast. It is helped a lot now, increasingly, by the trend to allow press to come to previews instead of having a big opening night, which was the tradition. So you have a little bit more time to think about it and write about it before the embargo lifts and the review goes live. So that's helpful with that. But in terms of workflow, it's not very interesting, but it's often spreadsheets.
Yeah.
So big spreadsheets which just have all the openings on, and you just have to update them constantly, pretty much. Yeah. And then I tend to commission about a month in advance. So that's how that works. So in the morning, if I'm writing myself, that will happen first. And then I have copy coming in from my team of writers, which I will then edit and put through to our production department. And that then goes online. But that's something that the workflow thing is something that's changed a lot again in the last sort of decade or so, in the sense that we've moved away from print. So it was commonplace before that you would have my deadline when I worked for The Times, if I was doing what we'd call an overnight, would be 11:15. So
PM, so straight after that show finishes.
Straight after that show.
Wow.
And I think the shortest amount of time I ever had to file a review was about 20 minutes.
Gosh.
And that was taxing. That was hard. Yeah. And the intensity of the pressure and the terrible feeling that you must surely have made some terrible mistake and that this matters to people, because there was all that intensity on this one opening night for the team, the creative team involved and the actors, as well as for you. And you've got an editor barking at you on the other end of the phone. That is now often, there's not a lot of that going on anymore. And obviously with the digital era, stuff can go on up as and when.
Yeah.
So you don't have that imperative of print deadlines in quite the same way. So that has altered things quite a lot. But still, you've got the race to be first. So it's not as if you can take your time, even now.
Yeah.
So it is a lot of pressure. And it is, I think you have to never lose sight of the fact that it's a huge privilege because this is not only people's livelihood but their heart and soul that you're that you're tap dancing over as you're trying to find the right adjective, you know.
And do you find, because obviously there has been such a change in the digital landscape of journalism, stories are repackaged now for social media, print, digital websites and so on. Has the role of criticism and reviewing changed then? Because some people may value that more of a blogger or influencer. Some people may value the diehard critics that have been on the scene for 20, 30 years. Mm. How have you seen maybe the role of criticism change within the arts?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really interesting, actually, because, I mean, you're right. It's, I think, reading a long piece of text something that not a lot of people really want to do anymore, frankly. I'm completely realistic about this. What I think is interesting is that people are still interested in long form content. So I don't, I mean, I'm sure a lot of my colleagues might disagree with me, but I personally don't necessarily see this as either a negative or a dumbing down. I just think it's a different way of consuming content. And it's inevitable because the world has changed.
Yep.
Vastly. I mean, it's almost unfathomable how much digitalization has changed the way we consume culture and art and commentary on it. So yes, of course, that's been huge. But I just think that probably as critics we need to start being a bit more creative in thinking about how we deliver our content, because it is my belief that people still want opinions that hold weight. I don't think they do just necessarily want sound bites, but they don't want to read a great big screen of text. And with the digital content, they'll often dip in and out. They'll come back to it later, you know, even if it's a podcast like this one. They might not sit and consume it all in one go.
But you should. I'm joking. But no, yes.
I mean, it's addictive.
No, but they could save it, or there's a particular part they always come back to.
Yeah. So I think that has altered it, and it will undoubtedly alter the shape of it and the structure of it. But I think that's no bad thing, actually. But it's very much work in progress, is what I'd say.
I think it's great that you've kind of got your eye on the horizon like that as a critic to stay relevant as well, because just as the same as an actor could be typecast, a reviewer could be typecast for the type of shows they always see or the words they always use. And I think, even if you say you're buying a new product like a Hoover or a fridge, you might ask a friend for a recommendation. You might read the reviews on that website. So it's exactly the same for a show. So whether you get that opinion from a social media influencer, a YouTuber or a critic, I think that voice is still really valid. Even though some people say, oh, get rid of the star system or get rid of this or that, I think criticism, you kind of need that there to kind of help keep creatives accountable.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there's probably... Well, there are multiple types of reader, but there is an argument that people are using it as a sort of user guide in some respects. So that definitely is one element of it. I mean, tickets, as we know, particularly for West End work, a lot of money. We're talking about major investment and it's cost of living crisis. And, you know, so that is a huge responsibility too, actually, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's incredibly important not to overpraise things because it simply isn't fair to that punter who's spending upwards of £200 in some cases. So there's that. But I do also think there's another type of reader who has seen the show already and just wants to kind of see whether their opinion is aligned to anybody else's or whether there are layers to it or sort of colours or textures in it that they would like to see articulated in a different way, or they can't put their finger on, or all that sort of thing, where it becomes about discourse as well and about the way that you experience art, actually, and what you get out of it. Because I think there are different ways of experiencing art as well. I mean, you can have a really feel-good night and not give it a huge amount of thought, or things can sort of take up residence in your head for years, can't they? And even change shape over time, and you can think back to something you saw years ago, and it will look different from a different angle. which is one of the things that I think is really interesting about theatre as an art form, actually.
I absolutely love what you've just said there in that, like, audience segmentation and knowing who you're writing for and your ideal client, because that's something I always, when I'm doing my workshops on branding, and I say, you have to know what you're selling and who is buying. You need to identify who that audience is and how to get your content in front of them. So I love that what you do now as a journalist and reviewer, you're reviewing it through your eyes, but for a different audience, which I think is actually, that's quite a skill set as well, to kind of bird's eye view that production.
Yeah, it's funny though, because it's, again, a bit like acting. If you were to think, you know, when you're acting, if you have a third eye on you, you're paralyzed.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Yeah. So if you do that, if you think, I must make sure I've tailored this for this particular consumer or reader or whatever, you can't write. You can't write honestly.
Yeah.
You suddenly become sort of hideously self-conscious, and it's just, it's like squeezing toothpaste out of an empty tube. It's agony. So you do have to sort of immerse, or at least I do. I can only speak for myself, but I find I have to immerse myself in the experience I've just had very much in the same way as I would as an actor. So I have to try and remember what it was I felt while I was sitting there watching it above all else. Yeah.
Because again, that's what will stay with an audience member, is how they felt, that emotion that it stirred.
Absolutely. And I just also think it's how you animate good prose, actually. Just as a writer, it's really important that it doesn't feel dry or mechanical.
Yeah. So as we mentioned, reviewers and the power of a review, whether you are an early doors producer, director, and it's your first show, your one man production, Edinburgh Fringe, or long running West End show, there is such value in it. You get 200-300 emails a day. What makes an email stand out in your inbox? Is it just a subject line? Is it the fact it's short and concise? Is it clickable links? What makes an email?
Oh, short and concise, please, for the love of God, for the love of God. And please, venue, dates, press night, in bold, in big, at the top, I beg of you, PRs, please don't make me wade through two pages of closely typed. That is the thing that drives me mad more than anything else, is the worst thing. Yeah. And it's exhausting when you're trying to find that information and you have this spreadsheet in front of you and limited time.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie, if it's laid out like that, there's a possibility it gets overlooked.
Yeah.
Because I'm a one-man band on that desk, and it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Especially if you're line managing your reviewers to know, is it a regional production? Are they in London? What's the calendar?
Yeah.
Is there a conflict in press night? Because sometimes now, not always, but there are sometimes when there's press nights on the same night.
Oh, increasingly. Seems to be happening more than it used to, strangely. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, it's like, is it a strategic turf war, or is it this accident or negligence? You just don't know, but sometimes you're like, oh, How's that happening?
Yeah. And press nights do come in clusters. That is really odd. I mean, obviously there's rise and fall, and there's the seasons, you know, if the back to school season in September, when there's always a lot of big openings, and the dip just before things like Edinburgh, when things go a little bit quieter, and obviously Christmas happens and Christmas is crazy. Yeah. And so there is a predictable shape to some of it, but then you will get months where there's sort of 2 weeks that are just completely and utterly bonkers, when the number of really big openings with really big names in them is staggering. It's really strange. I have no idea. I mean, I don't know, maybe someone else will be able to enlighten us on that, but that is something that seems to happen more than it used to.
So what advice would you give to someone who's listening or watching this, who is quite early on in their career, whether they're an actor and they're now producing their own work, or they've written their own play, and they want to get a reviewer or a journalist down, whether that's to review the show or to get a journalist to do a feature or an interview, what advice would you give to someone to try and hook that journalist or that reviewer into their show? Because again, especially if you are early doors on your production, that can really help leverage ticket sales if you get a good reviewer in or you get any press coverage. So maybe what advice would you give to anyone to get press coverage?
Oh, it's very difficult. I mean, it is budgets being what they are, it's very dependent on things like length of run and venue. But I would say, please don't let it be a revival of anything by Willie Russell. Please don't let it be yet another Tennessee Williams play. Probably don't do Shakespeare. Those would be my top tips, because we've seen enough of those things. All those things are wonderful. Well, you know.
Yeah.
I don't love Willie Russell. I don't need to see Shirley Valentine ever again in my life. I don't really need to see Glass Menagerie ever again in my life. Glass Menagerie is an amazing play.
Yeah.
I've seen it so many times. And I know not everybody has seen as much theatre as I have seen. But it is, again, bizarre how you get clumps of these things all occurring and you just think, you know, it's peculiar. It's peculiar that sometimes it feels like the industry is aiming for a very narrow section of the audience that's out there. And I would like to see a bit more daring and a bit more... I mean, if I was starting out, this is what I would do. I'd be completely reckless because you have nothing to lose, really. There's a very good chance that you're going to struggle, right? It's almost a given. It's going to be hard getting press in if no one's ever heard of you and you've got a short run and you're in a small venue. So why play it safe?
Yeah.
Do something dangerous and do something that you love and that you are passionate about and that you really feel the world needs to see. Don't try and give people what you think they want.
I think that's just so lovely to hear and refreshing because people might think, oh, this is a safe bet because it's tried and tested, this play or this venue. But actually, think outside the box because we don't just want to see the same blueprint. Even same with like when I worked as a journalist, there's only so many angles and hooks you can have on one story, isn't there?
That's it.
You don't want to keep obviously like flogging a dead horse, as they say. So I think be outrageous. I love that.
Yes, and don't follow trends. Just because there's been three plays about a particular subject that have done well, it doesn't mean that the world is hankering for a fourth.
Yeah.
You know, it really doesn't. And also, you know, write some characters. Not constant monologues. I do get quite bored with that.
Yeah.
People writing sort of semi-autobiographical monologues. It's probably the least interesting genre of early careers drama, I would say. Yeah.
And how important is networking to you as a... Because obviously, although you predominantly sit in the world of reviews now, you have wrote features before for multiple publications. Mm. How important is networking? Because I think on stage and off stage, networking is key in this industry. Not because you get more powerful the more people know who you are, but like the more people who can trust you as a brand, trust your work, it's so key to getting them in the room or getting your work published. So as a journalist, is networking quite important, would you say?
There are people, many, many people that are very, very much better at that than I am. I would not say I'm especially good at networking. I think that your work should speak for you, really, but obviously you've got to get their eyes on that in the first place. But I genuinely think actually that just seeing the best way in is just to see as much theatre as you physically and financially somehow can, whatever that might be. It could be really small scale stuff. But I also think, I mean, if a writer was to submit to me and they had reviewed something on Netflix or written a really brilliant analysis of an album of music, or an artwork that they'd been to see, and they'd written about it from a point of view that felt to me in some way performative and theatrical, I would still be really interested in that writer if the writing was strong enough. So I think that's how you do it, really. I think it's more about that than pressing the flesh and, you know, all of that stuff, the party going and the smiling and all that kind of... Obviously, that's good.
Yeah.
And once you get to know some editors, that is obviously really helpful, and maintaining those relationships is important.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, I would say what's important there, of course, it's great to be personable and helpful and pleasant if you meet the person and to have stuff to say for yourself. But much more important that you are reliable, much more important that you file your copy on time, much more important that you don't spell people's names wrong. You'd be surprised how much of that goes on.
Yeah.
So those are the things that I think really will keep people coming back to you and hiring you.
One thing I was really surprised as a journalist, like hitting word count is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And people sometimes like, oh, I'll just do 50 words over or 50 words under. I'm like, one or two words either way, fine. But like, hit that. So it's silly things like check dates, check names, file on time, ask if they need images and how they need them labelled. Stuff like that is so important. And I guess that will keep that reviewer in mind for you, won't it, if they've kind of hit those kind of standard business benchmarks?
Absolutely, and just kind of making things easier for you. Yeah. And I think there probably are misconceptions about editors and how they behave and what they expect and what sort of lives they live. But actually, I think most of us are quite sort of rattled and exhausted individuals with a lot on our plate, probably, you know, not making the kind of money that you might think. And if you are flexible and helpful and then you deliver the goods, then we will love you for it, trust. You know, we will.
What are some of the most overused adjectives or words you're seeing reviews that you, if someone is pitching to you, what should they not use?
Please never, ever, ever say of a set design, it is simple but effective. If you write this in a review, I will not be commissioning you. And that is a promise. That people say, you'd be astonished. Yeah. And just imagine you're that designer. That's how your work's been dismissed. It's simple and effective. What does that mean? It tells you nothing. Tells you nothing. Another one is flawed, but blah, 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 blah. I'm not a fan of.
Yeah.
I mean, explore what is right and what was wrong with the piece, what you liked and what you didn't, what works and what doesn't. But to summarize it, it's just lazy, basically. Yeah. And more to the point, it's so inexpressive. It doesn't get you anywhere in terms of your readership. It's not painting any vivid picture or giving any particular impression to your reader. So it's not use. I mean, you've just wasted those words. Yeah. Really?
I think what I hear is, which is great, is almost like, think of it as if you were the set designer or the lighting, how would you want your work to be perceived? And again, if you're an actor who's writing a show, think of, you will maybe dissect that character more, wouldn't you? So actually the same as like a journalist or reviewer, you must think, why are they thinking this?
Exactly. Or, yes, that's the question to be asking all the time. And why has that choice been made? And what might that person have intended? And what effect has it had? Has it succeeded in achieving what you imagine that person might have intended? Yeah. Of course, you know, we're not psychics.
Yeah.
So there is a chance you're going to be wrong about that sometimes. But that's where you have to make a case. And I think, even if it's not exactly what was intended, but you have interpreted it and shown how you arrived there, that is still valid and interesting, I think.
And I might get slaughtered for saying this, but that's why I think sometimes now in a social media influencer world, some of that journalistic grit or description gets lost. I even see it with interviewers now that have kind of come up. There are some amazing interviewers that have come through social media and they are amazing. And I'm like, yes, you utilize social media to get you where you should have been.
Yeah.
Fab. And then there's some content creators that create hilarious content, but then you put them in a different environment of interviewing and it's just not the same. Their audience aren't buying into it. They're not the same. And I think the same sometimes with reviews, because anyone can leave a review now.
That's right, yeah.
And yes, maybe read that view that's very biased and very in brand, but then maybe also read another one to get a true reflection. I think that's quite important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think even with the old school critics, actually, there is sometimes a tendency that creeps in to feel that the industry needs our support. So to be oversupportive. Yeah. And oversupportive is probably not the best way of putting it. But I do think overpraising is, it's not good for your readership, but actually don't think it's good for the art form either, because we need to be interrogating it all the time. Yeah. That's what we're there for. And sometimes that's uncomfortable. But if you go into doing a job like this thinking it's going to make you either A, rich or B, popular, then then you're nuts. And you're going to be sorely disappointed. So, yeah, I mean, I think you have to be prepared to say things that are not going to be popular sometimes and are not going to be pleasant for people to read necessarily, which is not to say that you should be deliberately cruel or catty or anything like that.
But I think what's important there is that actually you are trying to, when you said critiquing the art form, you want to make it, if it's a great show, you want it to have the longest shelf life it can. If it's a show that needs work, they almost need to know it needs work. Yeah. Sometimes when you're in the bubble so much, you're so biased to it yourself. If you've created the job, it's hard to sometimes think, actually, the audience didn't get that or this or that. So I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also, you know, if you're a regular theatre goer, there's certain elements of it that you are accustomed to and sort of take for granted in terms of the whole aesthetic of it as an art form. And so if I go with a friend who is not a regular theatre goer, it's always fascinating to me because I think we're so accustomed now to looking at screens. That is what we spend huge amount of our waking hours doing, whether it's our phone or it's Netflix or whatever it might be. And it is so utterly different from that, and generally a bit more heightened than that. And it is a sort of, it's a mental adjustment, isn't it? Sometimes that you go and sit down and it just feels completely different aesthetically. And you can see people that don't go very often having to sort of make that adjustment and finding it, frankly, quite weird.
Yeah.
Which I think is also valid, but worth bearing in mind that this is not, it is still a minority pursuit. You know, it just is.
Well, I have friends that work in TV and they say now that in writer's room and script development, there's that whole saying now, is it second screen enough? And basically what they mean by that is it second screen because someone's watching that TV show, but they're also on the phone.
Right.
So it can't necessarily always be that in depth.
Yes.
Or if they go away and come back a minute later, they still know what's going on. And theatre's probably one of the only mediums where it isn't second screen.
That is not an option.
But
yeah.
You do see people sometimes checking their phone and like, an hour 10 to an interval, like you can push through that. Because at the cinema now, I see it all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, come on, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is what the theatre demands of you in that respect as well. And, and even I am guilty of this, and I go to the theatre a lot. But, you know, if your mind wanders for a millisecond and you miss a plot point, you're thinking, oh, I need to rewind.
Yeah.
And then you can't, obviously. But that sort of feeling that you always can, because we're so accustomed to it, pause, rewind. I mean, we don't watch live telly anymore, do we? So it is a completely different kind of experience, and it does demand quite a lot from you
and they say concentration now is the biggest currency, isn't it?
That's it.
To demand. So, and I think that translates to theatre, in interviews, in podcasts. We're trying to, we're all fighting for people's attention.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, because you've been so amazing, I've got a quick lightning round of questions called Lights, Questions, Action. And I'm going to ask you some quick fire questions, and you are just going to answer whatever comes to your mind.
Oh dear.
Okay. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Already kind of touched on this one, but you can tell us more quickly. What was the first job you had in the industry?
Panto, yes.
What was the first show you ever reviewed?
Oh, it was a show called Father and Son, and it was at a theatre called The Man in the Moon, which was on King's Road, no longer exists.
Standing ovations, genuine appreciation or peer pressure?
Not a huge fan.
Thoughts on the star rating, yay or nay?
They are inescapable. So yay at this point.
Press night drink of choice?
Oh, vodka. Anything vodka based.
Favourite movie musical adaptation?
Oh, that's a tricky one. Okay, Lightning. West Side Story.
Okay, classic. Yep. If you weren't in show business, what would you be doing?
Gosh. I would be in a band. Well,
it's because you're also in a band. We haven't time to speak about that. But you were also in a band as well.
Well, that's what I'd like to be doing. I'd be even poorer.
But being artistically a band, fulfilled.
But so fulfilled.
Favourite show?
Show. Play, music, anything?
Yeah, anything.
Across the board. Ooh. Not I, Sam Beckett.
Okay. Kind of touched on this, but any hobbies you have outside of theatre reviewing?
Yeah, music obsessed.
Any particular genre you enjoy doing?
Indie rock is my thing, I would say. Yeah. But no, I mean, I love music.
Kind of, this isn't like lightning round, but this should be. But is it quite fulfilling, do you think, for all performers to have a side hobby or a side passion just to kind of keep them incentivized?
I think so, yeah. And I think it's very good for your sanity. Yeah.
Cheeky bonus question there. And then my last question, we've obviously just been on a podcast. Are you someone who likes to leave podcast-sized voice notes, or are you a text message person?
I'm a texter, I think. I'm a texter. Keep it brief. Keep it concise.
I think there's a theme there of you. Texts and emails, short and concise.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, none of those paragraph texts.
Perfect. Well, that's all. So I want to say thank you so much for tuning in or watching wherever you do. Make sure you leave your comment and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.